And you're listening to KBOO, Portland. 90.
Does your employer have a matching gifts program? Many companies offer dollar-for-dollar matching charitable contributions for donations you make to KBOO. The impact of your gift may be doubled or possibly tripled. Participating companies also match gifts made by retirees and or spouses. Matching gifts are a great way for you to maximize your membership dollars. Check with your company's human resources or accounting departments to find out if your employer matches charitable contributions, then request a matching gift form. For more information on companies making matching gifts, go to kboo.fm/employer matching.
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot fail.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. The other week, there was some rumblings coming out of the camp of Donald Trump. And one of the things that was highlighted was Stephen Miller, who was the senior advisor for Trump during his time in office. Talked about the fact that they were getting ready, or they had planned to start a denaturalization process, meaning looking at people who had citizenship and taking it away. You had one of these other folks talked about the fact that, or somebody else in the camp talked about that they used to have foreign-born communists and other folks who were deported for their political activities, and that these seeds need to be planted and revisited again. This is on top of a push to get rid of the amendment, the 14th, I believe, amendment that would allow folks to be citizens if they're born here. That's a big push, and that's something that's been outlined in Project 2025. And there's been a lot of attacks and undue attention, in my opinion, to, they don't use the word immigrant anymore. They just say migrant, the migrant population. They're eating dogs and cats in Ohio. They're taking over apartment complexes in Colorado. They're running roughshod in Chicago and New York. And the immigrants have become a boogeyman, with the solution being, if you put me in office, I'm going to make the biggest deportation machine the world has ever seen. And so I wanted to have a couple of people on. One is Lajiwa Salazar, who is a frequent guest on our show, somebody who's gone through the process and the battle around DACA. She's undocumented, but has been, you know, our go-to when it comes to these matters of immigration because of the work that she's done. I also wanted to bring in Eddie Zane, who we know for his tireless work as an activist, as an organizer with the New Breath Foundation, among other things, looking oftentimes at criminal justice and rights around that. But you, back in the 90s, were victim to what we're talking about, mass deportation. You got swept up in the fervor and was sent back to a place that you never been. And I wanted to have you both on to kind of share your experiences, your understanding, and also for people who are very cavalier about talking about this, like, well, you know, what's the big deal of the hardships and what sort of trauma and drama it could bring about. So welcome to the show, both of you. And let me start off with you, Eddie. When you're hearing this talk about denaturalizing people and shipping them off, how did that make you feel, considering what you went through once upon a time?
Well, happy New Breath, David D and everyone. I think, you know, starting with is that it's dehumanizing, right? That's the reaction that comes up, because people forgetting that we're all breathing, and as long as we're breathing, then that's the commonality that we're human beings, right?
Right.
And the way that the rhetoric and the action historically has been dehumanizing people that who they feel that we're less than. And then we're the undeserving, right? And so that all connects to the continued white supremacy and systemic racism that perpetuates intergenerational trauma through a federal policy.
Wow.
And so, I mean, the whole deportation thing and then trying to erode the family dynamic, the family structure, and the people that who helped build this country, it's go right back to the genocide of the Native Americans and the enslavement of the African Americans.
Let me ask you this. Can we get a little Eddie Zane 101? When you got deported, was it part of a retroactive policy where, almost like what they're talking about now, they looked and said, hey, this guy did something 20 years ago. he's a good citizen now, but it don't matter. I mean, talk a little bit about that for people who don't know your history.
Well, one of the things for me is that I was ordered deported after I spent 19 years in the state prison system, because at the age of 16, me and two of my friends, we committed a crime of home invasion robbery that led to kidnapped to commit robbery. And so when we were arrested and charged, we were actually charged as an adult and sentenced to life in prison with a possibility of parole. So after going through this whole process of incarceration in the state prisons, then because they revoked my permanent legal residency, right, as an immigrant coming to this country, and because of the criminal legal impact, Then they revoked my residency and then detained and ordered me deported. Despite all the support that I had and rehabilitation efforts, it really doesn't matter. And so one of the policy that really exacerbated on this retroactivity is the IRA-IRA law that passed in 1996. The IRA-IRA really stands for Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. And that policy passed through Congress because the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 by domestic terrorism to this white guy named Timothy McVeigh, right? Mm. When that happened, the government immediately saying that, oh, it's the terrorists from the Middle East and the people that who did the attack. And then, you know, they trying to sew up the borders. You know, it's a whole bunch of policy passed. And one of the policy was the IRA-IRA. And the IRA-IRA in partly states that, well, anyone who is not a citizen of the United States that who have committed a crime, aggravated felony, a crime of moral turpitude, they're automatically detained and deported, and the law is retroactive. So there's so many people fell under that policy, right? And so the separation of family happens, the perpetuation of intergenerational trauma, the whole neglect and dehumanization of people that who came to this country as a result of political policy that created proxy wars in other people's country, whether it's in mm-hmm. Southeast Asia or in Latin America, right?
Right.
And so, and we see that right now, right? It's happening right now in all the places where the U.S. government have a military base in.
Real talk. Let me ask you this before I bring in Lajiwa. When you were deported, what was that experience like? Because you hadn't been to where you were deported to.
Well, I have to kind of correct you on that. So I was very fortunate. I wasn't physically deported.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So that's a little different than many of the Southeast Asian refugees and then also some of the other immigrants and refugees that who actually were deported to a place where they have never been to. Because, for example, for many of the Southeast Asian refugees, because the U.S. policy, they targeted Cambodia more than any other kind of like the ethnic groups in the Southeast Asia. And so many of the people, you know, as a result of the war, they ended up coming through refugee camps, right? Specifically, many of the younger people, they were born in refugee camps. So they were never even been to the home country, the homeland they fled, their family fled out of, right?
Right.
So I was very fortunate just because the fact that, you know, they couldn't physically deport me because they couldn't get a travel document from the government, right, to deport me. So they ended up releasing me under supervision. And then eventually I was able to, you know, win my case in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal. And then eventually to be able to kind of remove all my deportable charges and become a citizen of the United States.
I appreciate that. You know, I guess I'm just remembering when we talked to you about it, the court cases and then just the description of what was happening to people who did get deported with all blurring together. So thank you for that correction. Lajiwa Salazar, let me bring you into this. You hearing about this, what does it make you feel? I can only imagine it must be a roller coaster because you're constantly dealing with, you know, will I get DACA? Will I not get DACA? Should I get DACA? All these different things that we've talked about over the years when it's dealing with immigration rights. Hearing this talk about denaturalization, mass deportations, people holding big rallies with that as a main theme, what goes on through your head and how are you seeing the lay of the land?
So personally, I am in a constant state of panic. I do have to reapply for my DACA every 2 years, which was fortunately approved a couple of weeks ago. However, it's now being heard. There is a court case being heard on the Supreme Court, which might repeal DACA. And I'm not certain what that will mean for current DACA recipients. I don't know if they will say you just cannot renew it, or they will just repeal the status immediately. And I do have a pending deportation case that was closed administratively the first time I got DACA. So hearing all these things of the changing immigration landscape as an undocumented person obviously is very anxiety-inducing. It also concerns me because I do have family members who have citizenship status that they have been able to receive through different avenues, and hearing the conversation around denaturalization, even for U.S.-born, I think the conversation has gone as far as like children of immigrants. So doing it similarly to the way that it's done in the U.K., where people don't automatically get citizenship, their parents have to have been born there. And obvious concern around what that means for folks who are children of immigrants, have never been to their parents' home country, their parents fled because of either political persecution or civil unrest, and now having to basically consider what it would look like to have to leave the only country they've ever known. Me personally, as a DACA recipient, I arrived in this country when I was 5. So I literally, if I get deported, I'm going to a country I've never set foot in since I was 5, have no idea of what it would be like to live there. And so obviously all of those things kind of bring up a lot of emotional distress, and trying to focus on the pure politics without, as Eddie mentioned, at the end of the day, we're people. At the end of the day, we're people. We are just trying to survive and having to deal with that on a daily basis. And seeing people rejoice at that idea is extremely unsettling.
You know, if you're talking, thinking about what you're going through versus the welcome mat that is given to others, you know, yeah. Let's roll out the red carpet and bring over Ukrainians, talk about, you know, political persecution is war. Let's make sure they got home. Let's say they got money. Let's make sure they're set up and they got a job. And on one hand, you know, you don't want to pit people against each other because that was done with the Cubans and Haitians. You know, I'm old enough to remember those days. Like, let's welcome the Cubans. Haitians, you go back, even though both were coming over in boats. But at the same time, there definitely seems to be a lot of animosity to those who are immediately south of the border, and I think are direct recipients of U.S. policy, as Eddie was explaining, with proxy war, and people of color, you know, Jamaicans, Nigerians, Ghanaians, or wherever. There's no welcome mat as there is with others. And I'm just wondering how you're processing that, because as you're dealing with that, we are seeing the welcoming of Ukrainians because they're fleeing a war, but, you know, they're ready to send you back.
Yeah, I would like to, you know, I've said this on the show before, but I would like to just mention that U.S. is in violation of international law by putting refugee seekers in detention or denying them. Legally, under international law, someone just has to reach a port of entry and let it not be known that they're trying to apply for refugee status. That in itself makes them not migrants, but refugee seekers. And as Eddie mentioned, a lot of these refugee seekers are seeking refuge from the political problems that the U.S. has caused abroad. Most of the refugee seekers are coming from Central America, and something crazy like almost 80% of the guns that that are found in Central America can be traced to the U.S. And so the U.S. not only profits, creates the political problems, but also supplies the weapons that people are fleeing from. And turning them away or putting them in detention is in direct violation of international law. And so off back, the problem is that we're, the U.S. is not only creating the issues, but is limiting the access to the legal avenues in which people can seek refuge. there's this dialogue of like, do it the right way. They are doing it the right way. That is actually legally what they're supposed to be doing. And they're being turned away or put in detention centers. And so as this stressful as it feels like for me to be worried about whether or not I'm going to be sent back, I cannot imagine what it would be like to walk thousands of miles to reach a port of entry and do things legally and then be turned away or be forced under this third country law that was instated by Trump and then upheld by Biden. So it's the issue is not even how folks get treated when they get here or whether or not they get the welcome mat. U.S. is violating international law by not allowing folks in when they reach the port of entry.
Lajua, I appreciate that. Let me ask both you and Eddie Vane. I started off in my opening remarks by talking about the constant demonization that is going on. Newspapers like the New York Post, if you want to call it that, but they're well-read, you know, specialize in just highlighting any sort of transgression by migrants. You know, there's always a story, it's always front page. There's a lot of fervor. You know, some of these TV stations that are more in a conservative bent will start off their lead with, you know, what is going on, what's the latest crime. So, you know, the latest headline is like, there was this big hurricane in Florida and, you know, five people were arrested and four of them were migrants. And you know, you get these type of demonization stories. How does one deal with that? Because that is now a cottage industry in terms of having that being reported, having that have activity around it, and then leading to policy, or at least giving people political policy. And I also want to parallel that with the type of ecosystem that's been developed on just looking at big cities and having all these websites that specialize in crime. Irony is that some of them, some of those sites are run by folks who are actually undocumented, but we could get into that. But that's a whole other thing itself. You know, your Oakland State of Mind, Oakland Short Criminals, Houston State of Mind, you can pick it. All these cities have these sites that will show people committing crimes, and they have clear video, a lot of them picked up from police, et cetera, et cetera. But it parallels the type of rhetoric that we see being highlighted with immigrants, you know. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on that demonization. To me, it makes it very hard to have to get some political traction when you have a lot of people having that, lawmakers at least having this constant barrage of the bad migrant imagery. I'll start off with you, Eddie, on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with the advancement of technology and social media, and then with all the political climate that we are in right now, I think the scapegoating of the bad governing of this country historically has always been focusing on minorities, people of color, when is convenient for either party for its political gains. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, they actually are doing amazingly well, right, in how to utilizing those national platforms to demonize and criminalize people of color. And right. So I think one of the challenge, many challenges, but one of them has to do with how the media is being bought by wealthy people, being bought by the people that who want to perpetuate a certain type of image as they need it to pretty much pass policies and secure the political positions. And so that is by any means necessary for them. And so when we continue to be pit against each other and divide and conquer, it only helped that 1% to continue to stay in power, not only in this country, but internationally, right? Mm-hmm. Because we cannot disconnect that You know, we can't just box ourselves in and thinking about, you know, locally and what's happening and why this policy is happening. It has all the connection to the international policies. And so part of, for me, is where is the media's, independent media's like KPFA, right, like Heart Not Radio, to be able to tell the truth? And how do you fact check things when something just so ridiculous that is being, that's coming out of the mouth of people supposed to be leaders, right? And for the people. And so that's right. Those are the things that we need to question.
Right, and that's that ecosystem, because, you know, the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, has been translated into, you know, if I do a story on the evil migrants, a lot of people are going to watch it and vicariously live through it and vicariously be entertained, almost like, wow, I'm sure glad I don't live next to Eddie. Sure glad I don't live next to Lajiwa. You know, all of a sudden, the people in those stories become your neighbors and people in your community. You start to see them with that lens. You don't see them as, it's a dehumanizing process. All of a sudden, everybody's evil, or has the potential to be. I want to ask you, the work that you do at New Breath has been very intentional in building bridges. And maybe you can describe this building bridges, bringing people together, putting everybody from different backgrounds in the same room, and having people get to know each other. How effective is that, you know, in the face of these media onslaughts? Does it make inroads? Does it make a difference? Is that model something that we have to really be intentional about maybe emulating, so that when somebody comes up and starts to do these type of mischaracterizations, we already have experience? It's like, oh, I already know the Eddies and Lajiwas and the DVDs, so that ain't true. and we can kind of minimize the type of harm that they seem bent on causing.
Yeah, I think part of it for me, Davey, is that, you know, when I first started New Breath Foundation from $0, it's really understanding that inequity in distribution of resources within the Asian American and the Hawaiian Pacific Islander community, that we receive, like on the national level, we received 0.2% of funding out of, 100%, which is 20 cents out of $100, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and then on the issue around mass incarceration and deportation and systemic violence, we get pennies out of that 20 cents, right?
Wow.
And so part of that is, once I was able to create a seat at the table, and then I was able to cultivate resources, that I want to distribute those resources to the members of the community within the Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander community, to really build up their sustainability and power, right? Especially many of the grassroots organizations who they're just doing because they care, and they run on a very tight budget. And so one of the things, when we fund these organizations, the value that we stand on is always racial solidarity, right?
Right.
So that's what allow us to be able to bring people together, is that the organization that we fund across the country, they work with other people of color, right, to address the intersection of those systemic oppressions.
Right.
When we're able to have cross-cultural engagements and dialogues and build opportunities to nurture trust, we dispel all the different myths and all these false narratives that being continued to perpetuate in our community, to have that scarcity mentality, right? So, I mean, you are more like a historian, and you've been around for a minute, and you already know how it's very convenient for people getting pit against each other, from the Asians and the Blacks, or the Latinx with the Blacks. And, you know, all this is stemmed from the anti-Blackness, right? The systemic anti-Blackness is perpetually globally. And then the anti-Asian violence is directly connected to the anti-Blackness. And so from that perspective, we're very clear about the three things in the New Breath Foundation. One is that we want to be able to focus on collective learning. Because when we're able to collectively learn about our culture and histories, that allow us the opportunity to do collective healing.
Yeah.
Right. And then when we're rooted in racial solidarity work, then we're able to embark on this journey of collective liberation.
Right? Yeah.
And so that's why we are very intentional about the funding organization that working side by side with other people of color folks, right? So we can shift that narrative and to be able to dispel any of those things that is being perpetuated in the social media on a national platform that is just not true.
No, real talk. And I think, and I, you know, appreciate the work that you all have been doing, and it's something that has to be uplifted more and more as the model and as the go-to and as something that, you know, is solution-based more than scare-based. Lajiwon, let me ask you this. First of all, you can build off anything that Eddie has said, but the other thing that has really struck me with this call for mass deportations, it's not about folks who might have crossed the border undocumented. And I don't even think it's about people who might have done some sort of quote-unquote crime. You know, I'm putting quotations of word around the word crime, because now what is being defined as crime is protest. So you're more likely to be in the crosshairs if you're an activist, if you're in the movement, if you're one of these people that's running around calling for an end to police violence or protesting, as they say, about the genocide in Palestine and or in Gaza and what have you. Now you're a criminal. Now you're seen as somebody who is, one, unappreciative of America. Two, you're in some sort of violation that they now want to conjure up, you know, and that becomes the grounds for deportation, which is, you know, what they said in that quote. You know, when we had these quote unquote anarchists, you know, when we've had these protesters, you know, we denaturalized them and sent them away. And that seems really scary, because now your rights can be trampled on, and God help you if you stand up for those rights, especially if you're an immigrant or come from that community. So your thoughts on kind of navigating that situation?
Yeah, I think one of the things that often feels unsettling to me is that I identify as a movement baby. I've been organizing since I was in high school, and it was unsettling, the idea of being deported and being taken to a country where people can literally get, you know, disappeared and murdered for organizing. And we now have the exact same thing here. People are targeted for their movement work and end up in detention camps. It does feel unsettling. It doesn't make me falter on my idea of the fact that it is our job to make sure that we leave the world a little bit better than when we got here. But it is unsettling to know that doing community work, doing movement work, can actually make you a target for deportation. And as you said, crimes that are not even, you know, using the air quotes, not crimes. I technically have a case for fraud, because the person who was handling my immigration case didn't believe my husband and I were married, simply because there were things that they were looking for that they didn't think were traditionally Mexican, even though I grew up here. So I'm not a quote traditional Mexican person. And so now I have a case for fraud against the United States, which is why Wow. I have a deportation case. Yeah. So the person handling my case asked why I didn't have a Catholic wedding. I didn't grow up Catholic. The person handling my immigration case asked why my parents weren't there. I eloped. And finally, they asked why my husband and I weren't living together at the time. I had a contract in LA, and we were traveling back and forth, and that looked very untraditional to her. And so they put me in deportation proceedings. And it's, you know, obviously not the most horrible case, because I was able to close the case administratively through DACA. But again, you know my disdain for the program, because DACA basically was approved because they're saying the children of immigrant irresponsible parents who brought them here without papers should not have to pay for their crimes. And I don't believe my parents made any mistakes by bringing me to this country.
Wow.
And
And yeah. so that just puts the extra burden on, you know, because now somebody can go, I saw her at this rally, you know.
Mm-hmm. And should DACA be repealed, my case can be opened at any point. And I'm already in some I technically had a deportation date.
Wow.
So if DACA gets repealed, or if I'm at a rally, or someone hears me on this show bad mouthing the United States immigration system, I could probably get in trouble for my quote anti-US rhetoric.
Jesus Christ. And that's what they were bragging about. That's the seed that needs to be planted, is what they said. You know, Stephen Miller and them. These are the things that need to be upheld. Eddie, your thoughts on that? Doing movement work. You do movement work, you know. And how do you feel when they're saying, you know, people that are to the left, people that are doing social justice work, people that are, you know, being too woke and DEI and all these type of dog whistles, you know, they don't like the U.S. Let's deport them out of here. Let's denaturalize them. Is the rhetoric and the seeds that they're trying to plant.
That's always a threat to the people. I mean, it's not just the people that who, you know, may be undocumented or who are in the middle of, you know, the asylum cases, or who are just kind of in limbo, right? And always have this fear of being separated from their family and just continue the perpetuation of dehumanization and trauma. But then it's also bigger than that, right? So when we talk about those individual impacts or organizational impacts or community impact, we have to look at how those policy is has multiple levels of impacts. Because when people voted for a certain policy, they only read a certain quotes or high level, but they don't look at the fine prints, right? So they may say, oh, this doesn't impact me because I'm not in that category as a DACA or undocumented on this. But when you really look at it, it impacts a lot of people that who, you know, as you see the rhetoric happening about even citizens, right? So I think for me, it's more so that the people who is on the ground doing the protesting, fighting for everyone's rights, you know, and dignity, is that they are more of at risk just because they're easily being targeted and scapegoated, right?
Right.
Because they're the one that who are living pain, that who are in experiencing that trauma in real time. So when they're fighting for collective liberation, they are fighting for their humanity, right? And so it's easy for the policies and the government, the rhetoric, say like, hey, we're only focusing on those people. But not these other people, not yet, at least, right? Let's focus on them so they can get that policy passed or perpetuate that kind of idea of this fear-mongering idea, right? So how to be able to make sure that we get the people out one group by another group. And so we've seen that continuously, you know, even when back in the days, well, when Obama was in office, right? He said, family's not felons. You know, it's like, what, family only, but then felons doesn't have family, right? So all this rhetoric continue to perpetuate it through all the presidents of the United States, not just one president. And so like what La Dudois was talking about is like that constant fear of just wanting to stand up for your rights, right? Your human rights, that's illegal, right?
Right, but we also have to draw a line in the sand and understand where they're coming from, in the sense that if you're protesting and you were part of the January 6th regime that stormed the Capitol, well, you're a patriot. If you're the people that was walking up with guns at the Capitols right here in Sacramento, Michigan, you know, pick a Capitol. Remember during COVID? You're a patriot. If you're the folks that's in Nevada that was shooting at police when they tried to move a guy off his ranch, right, and you came out protesting that, that's not the thing they're deporting you on. That's not what they're calling for. That's something they're encouraging and saying, this is, you know, the beauty of America where people get to, you know, voice and dissent. It's the folks that are showing the contradictions of America when we're pointing out the egregious things that are done, whether it's foreign policy that leads to people having to come here, or whether it's all the stuff around social justice issues, which means that a lot of people are supposed to have equity and equality, but don't, and you're bringing that to the forefront. Now it's a problem. Now it's an issue. And it seems to me the fear is that it's almost become fashionable to be anti-movement in some circles. You know, this talk about, oh, you're woke, you know, or you have people right here in Oakland cheering when they hear the FBI has been, you know, surveilling some of these movement people. Like, really? Like COINTELPRO and all the stuff that, you know, decimated movements, anti-war movements in the 50s and, I mean, the 60s and 70s, you're cheering. The return of that is something that is just baffling to me, but it's also laying groundwork for, so if these policies, as they're being proposed, get into action, people might not blink an eye, might not think there's anything wrong. Like, you shouldn't have been protesting, Eddie. You shouldn't have been out there, you know, holding up a picket sign saying, you know, stop the genocide, Lajiwa. You shouldn't have been doing that. If you love America, you know, you show your appreciation. And to me, that's just, I mean, everything's upside down now. You'll go to jail while 45 will actually, as he's promised, will release the people who stormed the Capitol.
Calling it a day of love? Yeah, it's I think, super interesting on when we want to uphold rights. So it's all about bodily autonomy when we don't wear masks and we don't get vaccinated for COVID, which has killed so many people. But it's not about bodily autonomy when we are talking about women's reproductive rights. So there's tons of contradiction, and the reality is that the folks in power are trying to self-perpetuate that power, and we are strong, and we are loud, and we are challenging that.
Real talk. As we close out, I want to get some last words from you. What would you like people to do? Are there any marching orders, Lajiwa?
So for me, get out and vote. I know that the system isn't perfect, and the two-party system is a pretty horrible system, but it is what we have, and we cannot have Donald Trump back in office, because it only emboldens the racist, the policies that further dehumanize folks of color, and that would be a tragedy. So and it would, I don't believe he probably would get out of office, because if Project 2025 goes through, we would lose a host of basic human rights. So
something,
get out the vote.
Something to think about. And that can happen if people kind of normalize some of the things that are what I think once upon a time would have just been outrageous transgressions. And now you have some people actually cheering them. You know, as I said, when you get people cheering, you know, mass surveillance by police in our own communities, the home of the Panthers that were decimated by police, that's crazy to me. That's crazy.
And
it's where we are.
One last thing, and that this is a little plug for an organization that is near and dear to my heart. We Testify's executive director has released Liberating Abortion, claiming our history, sharing our stories, and building reproductive future we deserve. And the book was recently released. So if you're an avid reader, it's a wonderful book to pick up.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Liberating Abortion, Claiming Our History, Sharing Our Stories, and Building the Reproductive Future We Deserve.
Appreciate that. We're going to have to get that author on our show, so we'll be calling you, Lajiwa Salazar. Thank you.
No problem.
Eddie Zane, appreciate you coming on. Last comments, thoughts?
Yeah.
Anything you want to leave us with?
Thank you, David D. I think, you know, we don't have to look. I mean, I agree with what Lajiwa kind of emphasized, you know, about voting. but voting with a conscience, right? Be civilly engaged, but then really understanding what you're voting for. The people, you know, in power, a lot of times is about, you know, tearing things down, you know, tearing the fabric of the family, you know, tearing the community down, and just tearing all the progress that we have made for everyone down, right? All the way from, you know, the civil rights movement. But what are we building? Right? How, what are we willing to build towards to? I think we have to start with the recall in Oakland, right? Mm-hmm. We need to elect the officials that really make a difference, like Carol Fife, right? Nikki Bass for supervisor. Stop the recall of the mayor of St. Town. You know, give them a chance to the lead. And then I think the other one, you know, on for me, you know, because I'm working on the Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander issues, you know, that's a big campaign. It's being led on a national level by the Southeast Asian Freedom Network, right? It's the SEER campaign, which stands for Southeast Asian Relief and Responsibility Campaign, right? And because next year is the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the U.S. war in Southeast Asia.
Mm.
You know, so 50 years. And people are still impacted today by that intergenerational trauma as a result of the United States foreign policy, you know. And we see it's going to repeat itself. We're seeing that happening right now with the war in Russia and Ukraine, right? Mm. And the genocide in Gaza with the Palestinians. You know, on that multiple level, we need to be able to vote with our conscience, we need to learn, and we need to continue to invest in racial solidarity. And that's the only way that we are able to get out of this collectively.
Appreciate that. How do we get a hold of you, Eddie?
Oh, well, our website is just www.new-breath.org. We're based in Oakland, California, but then we are a national community-led foundation.
There you go. I'm going to let you all roll. Thank you so much, Eddie Vane, Lajuwa Salazar. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
I came here as a child with dreams in my hands. Crossed the borders of struggle to a promised land. But they look at me now like I'm something to fear. Like I don't belong in the place I grew near. Bring down the walls of fear. Let's end mass deportations. Stop the tide of these cold-hearted family separations. We're here 'cause of wars America made and supplied. Now we seek peace in a land where we're barely allowed to survive. They say if I protest and dare take a stand for justice, for peace, I'll be a stranger again. My heart beats here, but I'm threatened to be removed. Labeled a danger by racists, my roots are disapproved. Bring down the walls of fear. Let's end mass deportations. Stop the tide of these cold-hearted family separations. We're here 'cause of wars America made and supplied. Now we seek peace in a land where we're barely allowed to survive. For some, while closing others down, lift some up high and turn the rest around. But I'll fight for a world where no one's cast away. The border crossed us, we have the the right to stay. I see my brothers, I see my sisters caught up in fear. Our voices quieted, but our spirit is clear. Stop mass deportations and family separations. No more deportations.
Ricky Hall, maestra of music. Her name was Bariki Hall Shabazz, but I knew her as Maestra, my music teacher. Her community knew her as Sister Bariki, or Mama Bariki, a black woman who was truly, as the saying goes, black on both sides. She lived her blackness by joining and supporting a wealth of black organizations. She was a self-described foot soldier in the now famous National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. She also supported the Congress of African People, the Republic of New Africa, the Black Radical Congress in Cobra, and the annual Congressional Black Caucus. She lived her blackness by singing and playing organ in her local church and as a performer with the Mary Caldwell Dawson Pittsburgh chapter of the National Association of Negro Musicians, where she sang as a soprano soloist. Sister Bariki loved music and performed on the stage as a professional, and shared with me the story of wondering if this work helped free our people. When she found it didn't, she left the stage. Bariki lived her blackness by loving black people. In October 2023, she was honored for her long-term support for the Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti, which provides education, literacy training, healthcare, and trade skills to Haiti's people. As a child, she spent extensive time with her grandparents, who shared stories and memories of their captivity on the R.J. Reynolds plantation in North Carolina. She learned as a child what it meant to be black in America. She was a teenager when the world learned about the brutal torture and murder of Emmett Till, the child from Chicago who went to Money, Mississippi, and was allegedly slain for whistling at a white woman. These events made Sister Bariki into a woman of strong will, determination, and deep compassion for the struggles of black people. Her friend, Martha Conley, introduced us, and after a discussion about music, offered her musical services when I said I regretted not being able to read music. So, for the next few years, Sister Bariki was my musical maestra, who brought flashcards, musical scores, and coached me on the do re mi scale. She made music make sense to me. I am forever indebted to my teacher, my maestra, Sister Bariki. Sister Bariki Hall Shabazz lived her blackness by raising a family of loving, conscious black people, most of whom attended and graduated from historically black colleges and universities. She is survived by her loving family, Dr. John R. Diggs, Jr., Khadija Tamu Diggs, Esquire, Malika E. Hall, and Delili T. Hall. She has three granddaughters, Kamaya Diggs, Makeda Diggs, and Savita Diggs. In her own words, Sister Bariki said, quote, "If anyone should ever think of me, do so in the attitude of my having been a long time dedicated foot soldier in the army of my Lord," unquote. On September 2nd, 2024, Sister Bariki Hall Shabazz, after 90 summers, transitioned to the embrace of her ancestors, where celestial music is played by the stars. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me, yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kinda crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they ready from the steel gray beef. Say, please, baby, they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, you beast and their lovers are neighbor to please. Make some shade on your name in the street. Because it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Yes, Coach.
Picasso,
what?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Listen to Armando Puentes every Sunday from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., playing the best in Tejano mixing with some traditional